Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's December 24th, 2011, in Rotterdam, Belgium, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 8, The Character of Bharat Maharaj, Text 14. Kriyayam nirvartyamanayam antaralepi utayotaya yadainam abhichakshita tarhi vavasa varshapati prakriti stena manasa tasma aisha ashate swasti stad vatsa te sarvata iti. Kriyayam. The activities of worshipping the Lord or performing ritualistic ceremonies. Nirvartyamananyam. Even without finishing. Antarale. At intervals in the middle. Api. Although. Utaya utaya. Repeatedly getting up. Yada, when, anam, the deer calf. Abhichakshita, would see, tarhi vava, at that time, saha, he, varshapatihi, Maharaj Bharat, prakriti stena, happy, manasa, within his mind, tasmai, unto it. Ashishaha ashate. Bestows benedictions. Svasti. All auspiciousness. Stat. Let there be. Vatsa. O my dear calf. Te. Unto you. Sarvataha. In all respects. Iti. Thus. Okay, just in the word for word, can anybody tell me what's happening here? What is Maharaj Bharat doing? Okay, that's a good idea. He's asking the calf to get up, but it's he who's getting up. Any other ideas, just in the word for word? He's focused on the deer. Translation. When Maharaj Bharat was actually worshipping the Lord or was engaged in some ritualistic ceremony, although his activities were unfinished, he would still, at intervals, get up and see where the deer was. Okay, can you all get this picture? So he's doing his worship, he's doing his meditation, which we read about in previous chapters, and he's not finished. And in the middle, over and over again, he's getting up. Utaya, utaya. He's getting up and he's getting up. And he's going to see, what's the deer doing? What's the deer doing? In this way, he would look for it. And when he would see that the deer was comfortably situated, his mind and heart would be very satisfied. So if he didn't know what the deer was doing, he was disturbed. And he's checking, what's the deer doing? Okay, the deer's okay. Okay, now I'm satisfied. Let me go back to my worship. And then he's doing his worship. What's he thinking? What's happening with the deer? What's happening with the deer? He gets up and checks. Okay, the deer's happy. Okay, now I'm peaceful and satisfied, goes back to do his worship. Oh, what's the deer doing? And he would bestow his blessings upon the deer, saying, my dear calf, may you be very happy in all respects. So whenever he'd see the calf, he'd say, just keep being happy, you know, all blessings. It's interesting, he's called here Varshapatihi. Varsha is attractive land. He was the master. Patihi means husband or master. He was the master of the earth. And now he's being distracted by a little deer. Purport. Because his attraction for the deer was so intense, Bharat Maharaja could not concentrate upon worshipping the Lord or performing his ritualistic ceremonies. Even though he was engaged in worshipping the deity, his mind was restless due to his inordinate affection. That's interesting. Inordinate affection. In other words, he had affection beyond what was required, what he was supposed to be doing. While trying to meditate, he would simply think of the deer, wondering where it had gone. Now, this is a really heavy sentence. In other words, if one's mind is distracted from worship, a mere show of worship will not be of any benefit. Should I read that again? Is everybody ready to be depressed and leave now? In other words, if one's mind is distracted from worship, a mere show of worship will not be of any benefit. The fact that Bharat Maharaj had to get up at intervals to look for the deer was simply a sign that he had fallen down from the spiritual platform. Translation again. When Maharaj Bharat was actually worshiping the Lord or was engaged in some ritualistic ceremony, although his activities were unfinished, he would still, at intervals, get up and see where the deer was. In this way, he would look for it. And when he could see that the deer was comfortably situated, his mind and heart would be very satisfied. And he would bestow his blessings upon the deer, saying, "My dear calf, may you be happy in all respects." So I was reading some writings of our lately departed Jamuna Devi, and she was speaking about how Srila Prabhupada's favorite Vaishnav song was Hari Hari Bifale. So I've been meditating on that song. And there, Bifale means uselessly. And Narottama Das Thakur says that I've been taking poison knowingly. So Prabhupada, in commenting, says you can take poison knowingly or unknowingly. Unknowingly, if you take poison, nobody will criticize. If with all good intentions, sometimes this happens, isn't it? That we think we've done our research and we have good intentions and we accidentally do something that's harmful for ourselves or others. But knowingly to take poison, that's suicide. That's madness. So here Bharat Maharaj is knowingly taking poison. Somebody asked yesterday, I don't see him here, about how is it possible that a person on this level of, you know, I don't mind, as long as she's not screaming. Children are allowed to, unless somebody else is really disturbed by it. Children are allowed to be children. Otherwise, you know, another 40, 50 years, that may be me, so you can try to be kind. So how is it possible? It's possible knowingly. Now, why would somebody on an elevated platform knowingly take poison? I mean, if we also think about ourselves, do we ever knowingly take poison? Do we ever knowingly, knowing this thing is bad for me, this thing is going to harm me, still do it? Why do we do it? Why do we do that? A weakness? Yeah, but okay, what kind of weakness? What's making us weak? All right, why are we attached to sense enjoyment? There's some lack of faith. There's a lack of faith that if I fully devote myself to Krishna, I'll be satisfied in all respects. Why else? Following the mind. Why are we following the mind? Any other thoughts? The mind is tricky. Yeah, then we're blaming the mind, though. Why not? Could be from past bad habits. But that's a little bit more unknowingly, past bad habits. Past bad habits is like you're in a forest and you've gone down a path over and over and over again. So it's worn. It's easy to go down. And the other path is all full of, it's overgrown. So you may go down the other path out of habit. That's almost unknowingly. I remember when we moved to a house that was very close to our first house. It was just one exit different on the highway. Do you use those words? Exit? Highway? I'm not sure. So one time when I was in a nearby town, I can't remember what I was doing, shopping or something, and I was driving home, I drove past the exit where our new house was, and I took the exit to our old house. And it wasn't until I was off the exit ramp that all of a sudden I realized, oh, I was driving what we call an automatic pilot because I had a habit. So I think that's more unknowingly. I think when our problem is due to past bad habits, it's more you're doing something before you realize that you're doing it. It's not really knowingly. That's my own opinion anyway. Why else would one knowingly drink poison? Yeah? Because we like to become intoxicated. Why? What's underneath that, yeah? We're looking for pleasure. That's unknowingly. So if it's ignorance, it's unknowing. Knowing means I know what the result's going to be. I know it's going to hurt me. It could be a lack of determination, right? What about pride? I'll be able to do this and not get hurt. I mean, that's the general mood. You know, I'll be able to play with Maya and I won't get burned. I'm stronger than Maya. And especially that's a problem as one makes spiritual advancement, although that's a general problem of the materialists. The general problem of the materialists is I can play with matter and it's not going to affect me. Just like, how many people think that they're affected by advertisements? If you ask the average person, are you affected by advertisements? Do you think they would say yes? They'd say, no, I buy what I want to buy. But if the advertisements didn't work, why would the company spend billions and billions of dollars on them? If advertisements don't lead to an increase in sales, you know, I mean, maybe a few companies would be foolish. But so obviously they do have an effect on people. But we have a kind of pride. It's not going to affect me. And especially as we advance in Krishna consciousness, we may think, well, I'm a devotee. You know, I can play around with Maya a little bit. Thank you. I can play around with Maya a little bit and I won't get burned. By the way, what offense is that? Maintaining attachment, certainly. But maintaining attachments is usually a faith problem. In spite of hearing so many instruction, one maintains attachments because one doesn't have faith. But here, Bharat Maharaj definitely has faith. Definitely has faith, definitely has knowledge. He has direct experience. Any other offense that this is? To commit sinful activities on the strength of chanting. Also, Prabhupada says his main offense was not consulting with his guru. But that also, we could see, could be a matter of pride. I don't need to ask anybody. I mean, it's not that we have to consult with people over petty things. You know, we don't have to consult with our guru, should I wear my red socks this morning or my orange socks this morning? That's absurd inquiries. Prabhupada says absurd inquiries are condemned. But if there's something that we know that this may affect my spiritual consciousness, then we need to consult and then we need to follow. And that he didn't do. So he was doing this knowingly. And of course, what's interesting is that as he became contaminated, then his consciousness changed. You know, we're not really sure here from the Bhagavatam to what extent he was aware that he was fallen at once he became fallen. So we're looking here also at the nature of the path of bhakti. That bhakti isn't just external behaviors. You know, Rupa Goswami, in defining bhakti, uses the word shilanam, or action. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Jiva Goswami, and of course our Srila Prabhupada, defines this action on two levels, internal and external, which is why Prabhupada used the term devotional service. So service is what you do, and devotion is how you feel. And they both need to be there. If I say, I have devotion for you, but I don't do anything, that devotion doesn't really have any meaning. Do you ever have people like that in your life who tell you how much they care about you, but when it comes to actually demonstrating that they care about you, there's nothing there? Or even there's something negative. Have we all experienced that? Oh, yeah, I'll do anything for you, whatever, you know. Oh, my car broke down. I have to get to the doctor. I'm sorry, watching my favorite TV show can't help you out. You know, we've all had situations like that where people say they're going to be there for us. They say they care for us. But when it comes down to it, they're not. And then, so that's devotion, so-called devotion, without service. And then there can be service without devotion. You know, one devotee was saying the other day how sometimes people offer to serve you, but they have some other motive. You know, and we've all met people like this too. Oh, I'd love to serve you. Let me clean your room. Let me wash your clothes. And really what they want to do is they want to manipulate you and control you. Or they want to get something from you. They want to get some money from you. They want to get some status from you. They're looking for something. Radhanaswami was talking about this in Chapati when we were just there about Kamsa and Narada. He said Kamsa respected Narada, but it was really he wanted something from Narada. He wanted information. Narada is like the transcendental intelligence gathering agency. Yeah. And the respect he paid to Narada was like the price. So I'm going to serve you, I'm going to respect you as a way of paying a price to get something back from you. So that's not the path of bhakti. Bhakti isn't either of those. It isn't that I'm doing service with some hidden motive for myself, nor is it that I have so-called devotion without any service. So I've given this example of the so-called devotion without any service many times, how in Boston, this is, oh my goodness, 35, 36 years ago, I remember one girl at the Sunday feast, and she said, well, I'm a disciple of Jesus. And I said, well, that's lovely. I said, suppose you didn't tell me that, and I looked at your life. How would I know? She said, well, you wouldn't. It's all in my heart. So that's not what bhakti is. Bhakti is both. And here we find that what's happening to Bharat Maharaj is he's allowing his devotion to move toward the deer instead of to Vishnu. He's still doing the external activities of service, but he's lost the devotion part. And we find sometimes people do the other. Sometimes people say, well, I still love Krishna. I still love Srila Prabhupada. You know, I believe in Krishna consciousness, but they've stopped any activities of service. Isn't it? Sometimes people back away from one or they back away from the other. Now, our path of bhakti is one of connection in love and relationship. It's not a mechanical process. And you can see that the mistake of thinking that if I do the externals without the devotion, I'm going to attain my result, is thinking bhakti is a mechanical process. That it's something I'm doing, I as the doer, and I'm going to compel Krishna to give me what I want by my activities. Of course, there are somewhat mechanical processes of purification. Karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana yoga are based on the strength of the performer and are primarily mechanical processes. In karma yoga, I do certain rituals where I offer the fruit. But even in karma yoga, there's a mentality of karma palatyaga, that I'm taking what I want to attain and giving that up for purification. It's still I, but instead of what I want to attain is heaven, it becomes I want to attain my own purification. But still, it's primarily external rituals. Jnana yoga is primarily the ritual of studying Vedanta, which Prakasananda Sarasvati criticized Mahaprabhu. Why aren't you studying Vedanta? But even in jnana yoga, it's not just study so that you can pass a test on trivia. You know, we've seen even exams like this in the Hare Krishna movement. What did Prabhupada say in the middle of this purport of this chapter? You all know what a trivia is? Looking at the minutiae of facts instead of overall ideas. So jnana yoga is not simply so you can say, this commentator said this over here at this time and made this argument. But jnana yoga is so by studying the Upanishads, you realize the self. And then dhyana yoga, people now take dhyana yoga as a kind of mechanistic exercise. Okay, you do pratyahara, you change your breathing. When you change your breathing, you change the ability to focus your mind. And then by pranayama, you have pratyahara, where you withdraw the senses from the sense objects. And through a mechanical system of meditation, you focus the mind on Vishnu. But even in Dhyan Yoga, the purpose is to gain knowledge and power. So the purpose of Karma Yoga is to get a mood of inner peace. The purpose of Dhyan Yoga is to get knowledge, and the purpose of Dhyan Yoga is to get knowledge, peace, and power. So there's also an internal component even for those yogas, although they do have a highly mechanical area as well. But bhakti really has nothing mechanical about it, because bhakti is all about relationship and about love. And our idea of bhakti is not really to work even for our own purification or our own knowledge or our own power, but simply to make Krishna happy. I mean, you see the perversion of this here with the deer, that he just wants the deer to be happy. You know, oh, my dear deer, please be happy. And if the deer's happy, then he's happy. So this is really the essence of bhakti. Is Krishna happy? Okay, then I'm happy. So although you could say that bhakti has a certain mechanical aspect, it doesn't really at all. Because in Dhyan Yoga, you're working with the mechanics of the body. Just like if you change your breathing, you change the way the mind works. We all know this. If you start breathing in a very regular and deep way, you'll start to feel... How will you feel? Light? And gradually you'll probably feel sleepy. I mean, don't try it right now, but... If you try breathing in a very regulated, deep fashion, after a while it's hard to stay awake. You'll fall asleep. And if you take very short, shallow breaths, you'll become on high alert. That's what the body does when you're in fear. So it's mechanical in that sense. It's working with a machine. If you breathe a certain way, you'll put your mind in a certain place. You do this, you put your body in a certain posture, you'll change the ability of your mind to focus. You know, in Karma Yoga, you're doing certain Vedic rituals. Now, but the so-called rituals of bhakti are meant simply to develop love and to express existing love. They're not really mechanical things. It's just like if you buy a flower for someone you love. Is that mechanical? No, it's just an expression of love. It's very different than I'm working with the machine of the body and the machine of the material energy. When we offer Krishna a lamp, we offer him incense. Why are we doing that? We're offering Krishna's incense. My dear Lord, my dear beloved, may your life be filled with fragrance. May your life be filled with light. May your life be filled with beauty. May you become happy. Krishna, may you become happy by smelling this incense. May you become happy by seeing these flowers. May you become happy by getting these lights. Not that I have a particular ritual. When we're engaged in our japa, it's not just, okay, I've got to move my fingers a certain way, and I've got to move... That's there, but that's not really what's happening at all. It's, Krishna, I'm spending some time with you, just with you. I'm just connecting with you. You know, there's a lot of talk, especially when women go out to work outside of the house, of that, well, the women can spend quality time with their children. But what they found is that quality time happens from quantity time. It's very hard to say, okay, let's spend 10 minutes of quality time together. You're just like, what do we say? What do we do? But if you're with somebody on a regular basis, then naturally there's going to be times when you connect on a deeper level. So we're saying, Krishna, I'm going to give you this time every day just to be with you, to provide the opportunity for that deeper level of connection. So again, it's not a ritual. It's saying, Krishna, I'm going to spend time with you. I'm going to spend time doing nothing else but just being with you. I think of it as, you know, the person working all day, and they're working for their family. They have the little picture of their family on their desk. So they're working for their family, but then they have a time that they're with their family. What is the use of a man who's working so hard for his family that you never see him? Prabhupada gave that example. He said he knew one family where the man would leave work, before the child woke up and come home after the child went to sleep. And when the child was 3 years old and he saw his father, he said, "Mommy, who's that man?" So we have some time, our like japa and kirtan, bhagavatam class. This is a time when I'm just with you, Krishna. I'm not, well, we're not supposed to be anyway, although some of you are. We're not supposed to be distracted by other things. Not, well, I'm with you, Krishna, kind of, you know, on the side. I remember one of my children, when he was young, whenever he talked to me, if I was doing something else, he'd get very upset. He'd say, "Mata, just pay attention to me." They even have that in books about parenting. You know, if you want to help your children be well behaved, when they talk to you, stop what you're doing and give them your full attention. Of course, you can't always do that if you have something on the stove. Even Mother Yasoda had that problem, that she had milk on the stove. And Krishna said, "Mother Yasoda, give me your full attention." And she's like, "Oh, I've got to take care of the milk." And then he got angry and he broke the pot. So then we may say, okay, hearing all this, instead of feeling enlivened, maybe I feel discouraged. And I just think, well, gosh, gee golly whiz. My mind's often distracted from worship, and all I'm making is a show of worship, and Prabhupada said it's not any benefit. Well, I guess I'm hopeless. Maybe I should just leave and do something else. I don't know, maybe some of you are thinking like that. So I was also meditating on the fact that at different stages of bhakti, different things are helpful or harmful. Now, just like when you're a very young child in school, we tell children, you cannot subtract a bigger number from a smaller number. Right? If a child tries to do 3 minus 5, we say, no, that doesn't work. It has to be 5 minus 3. But then you get to a point in mathematics where you can subtract a bigger number from a smaller number. And, of course, people in real life do that all the time. It's called debt. So at different stages of bhakti, Bhaktivinoda Thakura very nicely explains this in Bhaktiloka in the section on Niyamagraha, that there may be different rules and regulations. And if you imitate the rules and regulations of a higher stage, you're going to have difficulty and fall down. And if you're attached to the rules and regulations of a lower stage, you'll also have difficulty and fall down. If when you're 12, you say to your mathematics teacher, "This is nonsense telling me I can subtract a bigger number from a smaller number," you're going to fail the class. And Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, attachment to what's on a lower stage acts as chains around your feet. So the beginning of bhakti is adushraddha. And adushraddha, this beginning faith, comes generally from what we call agyata sukriti. Kriti means actions. Here we have the word kriyayam, actions. Sukriti, auspicious actions, agyata, without any knowledge. So there is no devotion. There is no knowledge. There is no intent to please Krishna. One's just doing some pious action. And of course, not just ordinary pious action, although Krishna says in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita that those who've acted piously in this life and in previous life can come to devotional service. But the most pious action, action in relation to Krishna. Therefore, Prabhupada would say things like, if someone just touches one of the books, they'll take birth in a good family. If they see the book and say, "Oh, very nice." You know, the drunk who brought some toilet paper into the 26th Second Avenue, Prabhupada said now he started his devotional service. So at the beginning stages of bhakti, actually what makes the fertile soil that when the devotee plants the seed of bhakti, it can grow, is this agyata sukriti, unknowing devotional service. When Prakasananda Sarasvati extended his hand to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to take him out of the area of where their feet were being washed, imagine how dirty of an area that was, where you're washing your feet from walking. Prabhupada says in that purport, the sannyasis walk barefoot, and your feet get very dirty, and you wash your feet, how dirty it will be, all the wet, dirty water. And he sat there, Mahaprabhu sat there, and Prakasananda Sarasvati extended his hand, and by that extending his hand to Mahaprabhu, that agyata sukriti, he didn't know I'm performing devotional service. He became qualified to understand Mahaprabhu's teachings. So that's necessary in the beginning. How in the beginning are you going to have devotion? How is it possible? You don't have any knowledge. You don't have any association. So therefore your activities are unknowing. And in the beginning of bhakti also, one is performing activities primarily just with the body. I mean, when one starts bhakti, one often believes that one has a lot of devotion. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur calls this false confidence. But really, one doesn't have devotion. One has devotion simply to oneself. One's devotion to Krishna is like a tiny trace. And therefore, one can only become active with one's body. And Prabhupada says, when you chant Hare Krishna, Krishna's pastimes automatically arise within the mind and the heart. Well, how can that happen if you don't even know Krishna's pastimes? And so in the beginning, one expects that chanting is going to be offensive, it's going to be mechanical, that one's service will be just with the body, it will be superficial. That's to be expected. This is explained very nicely in the Bhagavad Gita 12th chapter, at text 10. That one does the activities of bhakti at first not systematically, and then at first without really engaging the mind. But actual bhakti means to come to the point that one's mind is engaged. The idea of working just on the platform of the external body is that eventually you'll start thinking about what you're doing. And Prabhupada wrote this letter to Jayapataka Swami. He said that actual surrender means whatever I'm doing, doesn't matter what it is. From Krishna's perspective, there's not important and unimportant. And sorry, Radhai Chaitanya Prabhu, but whether you're cleaning the floor or whether you're the GBC chairman, in Krishna's eyes, it's all equal. No offense, please. Krishna is seeing the amount of devotion. And Prabhupada says, whether you're cleaning the marble or the floor, you're cleaning the deity. That to Krishna, it's all bhakti. He's not distinguishing between the person who's scrubbing the pots and the person who's cooking. So whatever service, whatever it may be, Prabhupada said in this letter, that you do it with your full attention to every detail. Let me do this nicely to please Krishna. Let me do this nicely to please Krishna. So that's the idea of first working on the platform of the body, that after some time I'll start, my mind will follow my body, and I'll start meditating on what I'm doing and who I'm doing it for and why I'm doing it. I won't be just doing it mechanically anymore. So this is called Abhyas Yoga, which is then chapter 12, text 9, where one is constantly bringing the mind back. And it starts just at intervals. Like here, Bharat Maharaj is doing the wrong thing in intervals. So while he's doing his external devotion, you know, he's thinking about his devotion, and then his mind, oh, what about the deer? Oh, what about the deer? Oh, what about the deer? So in the beginning, one may have just at intervals, oh yeah, what about Krishna? Oh yeah, what about Krishna? Right? One may be chanting mechanically, and then, oh yeah, Krishna. You think about Krishna for a few moments. And then again, what about Krishna? And what about Krishna? And eventually, Bharat Maharaj, from this interval, becomes totally attracted to the deer. So it starts with just bodily taking care of the deer, then it becomes that his mind is going at intervals to the deer, and eventually it becomes a total absorption in the deer. So that's the process of attachment, which Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, starting with text 62. That by contemplating, one becomes attached. Right? So that's actually the process of bhakti also. First it becomes just the activities of the body. Then at intervals, I'm thinking, oh yeah, what about Krishna? He's got beautiful soft lotus feet, and he plays his flute, and he had this really nice pastime of chastising Kaliya. And look what he's wearing today. What an interesting backdrop that is. It looks like the sun in a dark sky. Right? All the different seasonal forests in Vrindavan. And by meditating on Krishna, at least at intervals, after a while that meditation becomes concentrated. And after a while, one is thinking of Krishna all the time. At this point, one develops attachment and love for Krishna. So that's our process of bhakti. Now, how do we make progress on that steps? Well, first of all, we just hear about Krishna. I mean, a deer is so attractive. A little deer is attractive, isn't it? I mean, we have to admit, a baby, a fawn, is a very beautiful animal. But that attractiveness is a tiny part of a part of a part of a part of a part of Krishna's energy. What's actually attracting us is Krishna. I think it was the wives of the Brahmanas who explained this when Krishna told them to go back home. And they said, our families are only dear to us, Krishna, because you're there. You're the super soul. You're the self of the self. So whatever is attracting us in this world is actually Krishna. Krishna explains this so nicely in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He's the active principle of everything. So if I can become attracted to a deer, or whatever I'm attracted to, we each have things that we're attracted to, that our mind tends to go to. Some of us maybe meditate on our clothes. Some of us meditate on our family members. Some of us meditate on sporting events. You know, whatever our mind, we go to wherever we think is going to satisfy our desires. But whatever we're attracted to, what's really attracting us is Krishna. So just like I can become attracted to so many things in this world, I can meditate on so many things in this world. I already know how to do that. Bhakti is not a new art that needs to be learned. It's something we already all know how to do. Bharat and Maharaj didn't need training how to become attracted to the deer. And we don't need training how to be attracted and attached to anyone or anything. It's an automatic process. So we do the same process with Krishna. Hear about him, think about him, do things for him, and gradually we become more and more attracted to him. So this mere show of worship will not be any benefit. Prabhupada's speaking about someone on the higher stages. He's not talking about the very beginner. For the very beginner, this Agyata Sukriti is of great benefit. But gradually, that becomes less and less and less beneficial, less and less and less meaningful. You know, when I first meet somebody, it's just an official relationship, generally. Sometimes you first meet someone and immediately you feel some kinship with them. But generally, when you first meet someone, it's official. You can't even, what's their, you ask just, what's their name again? Where did I meet them? What did I do? Right? And gradually the relationships develop. So after having a relationship with somebody, if again you can't remember their name, right? If at that point it's just official, then you're in trouble. You know, if after 15 years of marriage, you bring your wife a flower on your anniversary just because you're afraid, otherwise she won't cook for you. And you really don't have any affection for her. So that's a problem. You know, in the old system of arranged marriages, Prabhupada said that the girl and boy would have some ceremony when they were still children before they lived together as husband and wife, and then the elders would have them meet sometimes and just say, okay, here's a plate of sweets, give this to your husband. And the little girl, she didn't have any feelings yet, but just because her mother and father said so, she'd bring the plates, give it to him. So in the beginning of a relationship, that's normal. Prabhupada uses this as an analogy of development of bhakti. But once the relationship is developed, to do this is very dangerous. And not only is it not of any benefit, but it actually causes harm to the relationship. And if I'm speaking to someone with whom I already have a relationship and they don't care about what I'm saying, they don't care about what's happening with me, then I feel hurt. And so Krishna similarly feels hurt. He feels offended. So here we see again, Bharat Maharaj is, for whatever reason, we don't know what's in his heart, whether he's feeling some pride or whatever is going on, but somehow or other, he's knowingly drinking poison. He's knowing this is a dangerous thing to do, and he thinks, I can do it anyway. And therefore, his devotion starts slipping down to a lower level. It starts slipping down to the level of the beginner who's acting just mechanically. Therefore, he's not making any further advancement. Now, as was so nicely said yesterday by Mahaprabhu, how whatever we do in bhakti always stays. So even though he slips down to a lower level, what he's achieved isn't lost. And therefore, later on, when he goes to revive it in his next body, it's still there for them, for him. And I was really thinking about how amazing Krishna is. That in my material relationships, it doesn't work like that. If I've established some relationship with somebody else, and it's gone to a very deep level of intimacy and respect and trust, and then I do something to really damage that relationship, I can't start where I left off. I have to often take quite a bit of time to build up the relationship again. And how kind Krishna is, that even if someone has some difficulty or some weakness or even knowingly and even offensive, Krishna says, okay, whatever we've done, you can come back to that at any time. And that's a great level of his kindness. So we should definitely try in our lives to become more Krishna conscious. And first of all, we should be honest what level that I'm at, and then always trying to be increasing our Krishna consciousness. And again, it's a very simple thing. At least at intervals. What's Krishna doing? Is Krishna happy? If we're not at the point where we can be doing this constantly, then at least periodically, just like Bharat Maharaj just keeps checking on the deer because that's where his heart is. Whatever he's doing, is my deer okay? Is my deer okay? Is my deer okay? What's he doing? Did he get lost? Did he get hurt? Is he satisfied? Oh, my deer, please be happy. So at least throughout the day, what's Krishna doing? What's Krishna doing? Is he happy? Is he happy with what I'm doing? Am I pleasing him by my activities? Is he smiling at me? Am I doing this in such a way that Krishna will like, that Guru will like? And as we do that more and more and more, maybe for some of us we can start with 1 minute a day. Is Krishna happy? And maybe for some of us we're at the point where it should be, 5 hours a day. And this is how we can gauge our progress. And I particularly noticed that this, I made a shift in my own life when one of my godbrothers died. And somehow, I don't know why, particularly at his passing, all of a sudden it occurred to me, how are you gauging your advancement? And I realized that what I had been doing for years was when I went to bed at night, I had a little mental checklist. 16 rounds done, 3 Gayatris done. Reading Prabhupada's books for some time today, done. Doing the whatever service I had to do, okay, done. I was just looking at the externals. And then somehow or other, as I said, I don't know exactly why it sparked it. I started thinking, okay, how long have I spent thinking about Krishna today? 2 minutes? Okay, 2 minutes, great. 5 minutes, 10 minutes? How much of the day was I actually Krishna conscious? And I know of one devotee who keeps a sadhana record for himself every day. How many rounds did I chant? How many of the rounds were focused rounds? How much did I read? How much of my reading was meditative? To really be looking at ourselves that way. How much am I actually connecting in a relationship of love with Krishna? Otherwise, we may be disappointed. Prabhupada said, whatever you're doing, the test is Ante Narayana Smriti. Maybe disappointed that externally I was engaged in the process of bhakti, but my devotion was elsewhere. And then our progress will be very slight. That's just the very beginning levels. That's not what we ultimately want to achieve. And of course, how can we help to focus our mind on Krishna? Well, that I think everybody knows that, but I can just repeat it for completeness. First of all, you got to hear about Krishna. You can't think about somebody you don't know anything about. And frequent hearing, daily hearing. We have our wonderful Krishna book. You can read Krishna book over and over and over again, even if you just read one line a day or one paragraph a day, and then just meditate on that. One place Prabhupada said, if you have one pastime that you think about over and over again, that's sufficient. So you can have one pastime you really like, whatever it is, doesn't matter, and meditate on that. Some pastime of Chaitanya, we have Chaitanya Charitamrita, all of Mahaprabhu's wonderful pastimes, to hear about them. And if you don't have any time to read, then there's devotees who've read the books and have them recorded. And for just a small amount of money, you can buy a little MP3 player and stick it in your pocket and listen to somebody reading the pastimes of Krishna. Even while you're running around the universe. I know of one devotee who had let his practices lapse for many years. And he had a job where he had to do a lot of driving. I don't remember exactly what the job was. And I think it was just circumstantial that he found a box of recordings, CDs or cassette tapes, I don't remember how long ago it was, of a devotee reading Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he started playing it in the car over again and over again and over again and over again till he really knew the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And gradually he revived his whole Krishna consciousness from that. If that's too complicated, you can get the recordings of the devotees singing the songs for children about Krishna's pastimes and sing that, little English songs about Krishna's pastimes. There's devotees who've made Krishna book into English songs with little rhymes and melodies, and you can sing those. As somehow or other to hear about Krishna, to hear Prabhupada's lectures where Prabhupada's talking about Krishna, and to have at least some quality time every day where you're hearing about Krishna. And then throughout the day, try to meditate on what you heard. Think about it. Stop for a minute. Think, what did I read today? What did I hear today? And then, of course, who we associate with. Are we associating with people who talk about Krishna? Are we associating with other people? And then the purity of our life. It's very hard to focus our mind on Krishna if we're eating food cooked by non-devotees. If we're seeing mundane entertainment, then we'll think about that. You know, if we're absorbed in the activities of the world, then naturally we'll think about that. And of course, also, the humility and surrender piece. I really need to think about Krishna. I really need to connect with Krishna. I don't have my life all together. Everything's not just wonderful here. I have a wonderful life of material enjoyment. And, you know, everything's fine. I've got the wonderful prasadam at Radha Desh, and my room has a heater in it, and I don't have to think about Krishna. You know, but a real feeling that I, without Krishna, I don't have anything. I'm adrift in the ocean of material life. And I don't have the ability to focus my mind on Krishna on my own. Right? Calling out for Krishna, calling out for the Vaishnavas, please help me. Krishna, please manifest in my mind. Oh, great devotees of the Lord, please help me to have Krishna manifest in my mind. Not thinking that by some mechanical process of karma yoga, gyan yoga, or dhyan yoga, I'm going to be able to force Krishna to manifest in my mind. But he'll come there if it's a nice, clean, sweet, beautiful place to sit. So in this way, we can actually become Krishna conscious and avoid this Krishna conscious and avoid this problem that Bharat Maharaj had. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes, Prabhu. What would have been his proper behavior? Well, Prabhupada said he should have gone to his guru, Pulahamuni, who was there at the ashram and consulted with him. So we can only speculate what Pulahamuni would have told him. I don't know. But then he would have had to follow the instructions of Pulahamuni. I mean, we can posit a number of possible scenarios that he could have taken care of the baby deer till it was old enough to be on its own, but without this attachment, without feeling that I'm the doer, without feeling that, you know, it's up to me whether the deer lives or dies as a service, just as previously he'd taken care of the kingdom as a service. That's possible. That's certainly one possible alternative. I mean, another thing is that he could have just, a baby deer after a very short time is able to get food on their own, that he could have just taken care of it until it was able to get food on its own and go into the forest rather than keeping it and looking after it like that. I think there's many possible scenarios. I mean, we have, on the other hand, the example of Shivananda Sen. I think Shivananda Sen shows us the example of how a Vaishnava takes care of a surrendered animal without becoming materially attached. And not only did Shivananda Sen not become materially attached, he liberated the dog. So here we have the deer compromises Bharat, whereas with Shivananda Sen benefits the dog. I think we all see this just like we go out and preach to non-devotees. So do I become a non-devotee or do they become a devotee? That's the question. Many of us work out in the world. Do we become like the world or do we transform whom we touch? So there obviously is a way from Shivananda Sen's example of dealing with a surrendered creature so that you benefit the creature. That's, you know, and so many devotees have taken care of animals, especially cows. And, you know, most of us don't worry that we're going to take birth as a cow. So we don't say, oh, don't keep any cows on the property because you may get inordinately, probably uses the word inordinate affection. You may have some inordinate affection and take birth as a cow. Or in Mayapur, we have the elephants, you know. And there's not big signs up be very careful about becoming attached to the elephant, so you'll take birth as an elephant. So I think we know that there's ways, or like with our family. We don't say, okay, you know, as soon as your child is born, leave them outside in the cold to die because you might get attached. So we know that there's a process by which we can be kind and caring to other living beings and take care of other living beings in such a way that we elevate our Krishna consciousness rather than degrade that. I mean, having said that, there's devotees like Madhavendra Puri who traveled alone because he was concerned that if he traveled with anyone else, he would engage in prajalpa. And there are devotees who at a certain point in their life, at least, live as an avaduta. Maharaj Yudhisthira Pandavas, at the end of their reign, lived as avadutas. Bharat in his next life, as a, his next human life, lives as an avaduta, where even externally, they don't have any kind of contact with any other living being out of concern that I won't be able to handle it properly. So that also may be there. I mean, and that's the wisdom of the guru and the senior devotees, that they may say, look, for you, particular person, you shouldn't take care of the cows because you're going to become one if you do. And for you, you can take care of the cows as a service. You know, that's the vision of the senior persons. Or, you know, with household life, do husband and wife stay together as vanaprasthas for their whole life? Do they separate as vanaprasthas? Does the husband take sannyas? That depends on the person. So you may see in this case, husband and wife have now developed a purely spiritual relationship and they can live together or not and it doesn't matter. They're not degrading each other. And in a certain case, one may say, well, this isn't really working very well. You know, you're already 65, go take sannyas. So that, we have a very personal philosophy. And things are done very personally. And what may be entangling for me may not be entangling for you, and vice versa. That depends. And that may change at different times in our life. So at certain times in my life, what's good for my Krishna consciousness may 10 years later be bad for my Krishna consciousness. That's also true. I mean, what may actually facilitate my thinking of Krishna and may be a stepping stone to thinking of Krishna, just like these kings, like Bharat Maharaj. So at first, that's their service to Krishna, to rule the land, take care of the deer. My God, he was taking care of everybody on the planet. He was taking care of all the deer and all of the cows and all of the dogs and all of the humans and all of everything. And that was facilitating his Krishna consciousness. It was his service. And now at this point in his life, that very same thing was an impediment to his service. So is that all right? And you had something else too? I don't know, we're going a little late. So somebody else? Anything? Yes? Well, we don't want to avoid services that have full absorption of the mind. I give you a couple answers to that. One is Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, yam yam vapi sram bhavam tajitante kalevaram, whatever you think about at the time of death. And right after that, he says, okay, what should you do, Arjuna? So Arjuna keeps thinking, if I'm going to be like that, I should leave this battlefield and go to the forest and just meditate on Krishna. But what does Krishna say in 8:7? Mam anusmaram yudha cha. Mam, my, anusmaram, smaram is remember, yudha, fight, cha, also. Now, I've never fought in this body, in this life anyway, and I don't remember ever having been a warrior in other lives. Maybe I have been at some point. But we'll assume that being on a battlefield is very mentally engaging. I would imagine so. In fact, I just finished reading a book about developing your spontaneous intuitive thinking. And one of the points they made was that 90% of police officers never have fired a gun. You know, and I mean, they haven't practiced, but not against another human. And when police officers fire a gun, that they universally report a very strange phenomena, that their brain starts shutting down certain aspects of their sense perception. They often stop hearing anything. They just lose all sound. They start seeing things happening in slow motion. And their vision becomes very narrowly focused. So they may only see the criminal's chest or the criminal's like face and right hand, and they don't see the left hand. I was thinking about Arjuna when he was shooting at the bird and he only saw the eye of the bird. That this happens to police officers spontaneously, mechanically, in their body and mind when they're under extreme stress. But Arjuna could turn that on at will, obviously, where he was only seeing the eye of, he didn't see anything else. So when you're in combat, you go to a kind of samadhi, obviously. They were going to a kind of pratyahara and samadhi, where they were so focused that any extraneous detail was put to the side, and they were able to have heightened sense perception of what they needed to focus on. So talk about concentration. You know, that's really concentration. Where you and we notice this when we're very focused on something, we don't even see what else is in the room. And then not only are you focused on your target, but you're trying to avoid being killed. So your enemies are similarly focused on you. Now you might say, in such a state, how can you possibly think of Krishna? Mam anusmaram yujyacha. Think of me while you fight. So Krishna is saying, think of me while you fight. I mean, he's giving the example of something that requires probably the most focus of anything possible. And still think of me. And we have the example of Bhishma. When Bhishma is leaving his body, it says that that man, who he had fought on thousands of battlefields with thousands of men, and he could speak on thousands of subjects with thousands of meanings, but now he withdrew his mind from all other subject matter and fixed it fully on the Supreme Lord who was present before him. And Prabhupada says in that purport that as a responsible person, Bhishma had to take care of so many things, so his mind was strewn all over so many subject matters, and now he fixed it exclusively on Krishna. So how can you put those two things together, that Krishna is saying, Mam anusmaram yujyacha, and that Bhishma at the end was withdrawing his mind from everything and fixing it on Krishna? So one friend of mine, when she was going to get married, she hadn't met the boy yet. She was just corresponding with him. She was over phone and computer and chat, and she was doing that for 3 weeks before she met him, and she was a teacher in our Gurukula. And she told me, she said that during those 3 weeks before she met him, that she could hardly eat. She said she was thinking about him so much that she lost weight from not eating. She said it was hard for her to sleep. And she said what was really interesting is that when I was teaching a class, even on math or science, that required a lot of mental concentration, I never forgot about this boy. So how do you mam anusmaram yujyacha? There has to be love. There has to be attachment. And I think when we have those times when Krishna totally flees from our mind, that's a measure for us of this is how much attachment I have. You know, so our process isn't that we give up all mentally engaging things and we go to the forest and perform some kind of jhana yoga. But we have that as an indicator that, well, I need to increase my attachment to Krishna. Now, of course, if I'm attached to Krishna, I'm also going to want to do my service for him very expertly. With full attention, like Prabhupada says in this letter to Jayapataka Swami, with full attention to every detail. And when there's great love, one can have both. Full attention to every detail and never losing sight of the beloved for whom one is doing that. So on a beginning stage, one may just have to say, Krishna, I'm dedicating this to you. And I'm doing this with full attention to every detail for your pleasure, and I hope you smile at me while I'm doing that. But in the process of doing it, Krishna may flee from our consciousness. And we may, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be thinking of Krishna. Maybe just at intervals, like Bharat. Was, oh yeah, is Krishna smiling? And then again I'm focused, oh yeah, is Krishna smiling? You know? But gradually, as we perform bhakti, it should become more, this is very nice explained in Nectar of Instruction, text 8, purport. It should gradually become more of a constant, uninterrupted stream. And we see in the lives of the acharyas, they were doing so many things. And yet, they were uninterrupted. There wasn't a moment when Krishna was out of their consciousness. But that ultimately requires love. It's not something you can do mechanically. It's not something you can do just by pasting pictures of Krishna all around the screen of your computer. You know, or like making some little hat. I saw a devotee this once, made a little hat out of a wire that hung in the front, like they put a carrot in front of a donkey, you know, and had his favorite picture of Krishna all the time. So that's, you know, that's, it's not going to be quite like that. So I hope that answers your question. I think we're running out of time. Is there anything urgent? Because what was the other thing you wanted to ask? We can see if we can do it quickly. How to learn from the role models of the Bhagavatam. Therefore, read Chaitanya Charitamrita. Read Chaitanya Charitamrita. I remember we used to have a hot-off-the-press account where we would get Prabhupada's books as they were translated. So I think when Prabhupada was in the middle of the fourth or fifth canto, I think it was fourth canto, he switched to Chaitanya Charitamrita. And then, of course, they did the 17 books in 2 months. And my own personal experience was exactly like that. I was reading Bhagavatam and thinking, I can't relate to these people. I can't relate to somebody who makes, you know, interplanetary traveling cities. Just, what does that have to do with me? I mean, of course, you can actually see that the Bhagavatam does relate to us. But if it's a little difficult, read Chaitanya Charitamrita. When you read Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's like reading about ISKCON. It's like reading about the activities of ISKCON devotees in another part of the world. Yes, and yes, it's the highest scripture, but we can relate to it. That's why Mahaprabhu came. Mahaprabhu came specifically. He came in Kali Yuga just 500 years ago, not 5,000 years ago. 5,000 years ago, there were still great mystic demons that could take the shape of a huge 12-mile-long snake. You know, maybe the scientists are digging up their bones now and finding them, calling them dinosaurs. But, you know, that's not our experience anymore. I don't experience 12-mile-long snakes and interplanetary birds and, you know, it's... But the world I'm experiencing is that of Mahaprabhu. And he's showing how to be a Vaishnava. So look at the exchanges of love between the devotees of Mahaprabhu. See how they develop their bhakti. See how they develop their renunciation. See in Mahaprabhu's life itself, how does he develop? How does he apparently develop as a devotee? So we have that Shastra also. And then, of course, we have our Srila Prabhupada and all of our acharyas in our line, even after Mahaprabhu, who give us these examples. And then, you know, we've got a lot of nice people walking around the planet now who are good role models, too. It's not that they're all, it's all people from the past. If we don't have any good role models now, then what's the use of our Hare Krishna movement? You know, if everybody in the Hare Krishna movement is just on the platform of Adushada, that's not much use. So we have people now. Look for them. Pray for them. They're around. And see what they're doing. How are they doing it? And ask them how they're doing it. Is that all right? A funny question? I think we have like 3 seconds. I don't know. You have to ask the boss. Of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. I was also thinking, I didn't bring this up, but I was also thinking those of us who have very young children, you have to do that. You know, I thought about saying this, but I never got to it. You know, I've heard in some japa workshops where devotees will say, the best japa is you just sit in one place for 16 rounds, you don't move, you know, or at least for 4 rounds at a time, you don't like move a muscle in your face or your arms, you stay perfectly still like a statue. And, you know, and I thought these people are obvious. First of all, I've only heard that from men. And second of all, I only heard that from men who didn't have children. I thought, you know, if you're a mother of young children, you have to be looking and what is my child doing? What is my child doing? What is my child doing? Are they okay? Are they okay? Are they okay? You have to do that. Otherwise, you're going to finish your 16 rounds and you're going to be very surprised at what you find in your house. Or your child may be injured even. You know, you may have a bathtub full of ghee. And I mean, I actually know of one devotee who she made the mistake of coming to the temple to do deity worship and leaving her 3-year-old child home alone. So the first one time when she came back, she found that he had done an abhishek for all of her pictures. So he put all of her photographs in the middle of the room, and he was pouring water over them. And she said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm doing abhishek." And somehow she didn't learn from that. And the next time she came back, he was doing a fire jagya. So after that, she didn't leave him home alone anymore. So, sometimes we have a service where it's part of our service also to be aware of what's going on. But the problem here was this inordinate affection. You know, that his real interest became the deer. His real interest became the deer, not his bhakti. We should be just the opposite. Rupa Goswami gives the example of a person who's in love with someone other than their spouse. And they're taking care of their home, they're taking care of their spouse. But actually, they're thinking about their other lover. So we should be with Krishna the way Bharat was with the deer. That we're doing things in the world, but our minds are always going to Krishna. We're always checking, what's Krishna doing? What's Krishna doing? What's Krishna doing? Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you.